Peter 3. We'll deal with verses 13 and 14 here as a unit. Verses 13 through 17. The title is When Peace is Rejected and Undeserved Suffering Exists. In verse 13, the force of this verse, negative volition cannot thwart the expression of positive volition. Looking at the Greek here, who earlier bypassed the original question of the Psalm reference in verses 10 through 12, now inserts his own question at the end of reference to them. And who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? Connecting tie, followed with the interrogative pronoun tis, T-I-S, who, with the question mark, who is there to harm you? To harm here is a definite article with the substantival participle, future active, nominative masculine singular. Look into the future. O, kakao. K A K O O. The family of words for evil, kakas. Literally, the one that will harm or mistreat. That's used six times. You, obviously, reference to the believers to whom he's writing. A pronoun C. If you prove zealous for what is good. We have here for this verse a third class condition introduced by the particle in, E-A-N, called the subjunctive mood, of the word prove, which is aorist opponent subjunctive, genomai, to become literally, G-I-N-O-M-A-I, here translated prove, evidence. Zealous for what is good. Zealous is the noun, non-deep masculine plural here, zelotes. Z-E-L-O-T-E-S. Obviously, it denotes one that is eager or enthusiastic. Zealous. It's used eight times. If you prove zealous, and then the zeal here is directed to for what is good. What is good? Is the definite article with the adjective used pronominally here, to agathos, in neuter singular, A-G-A-T-H-O-S. Other good. Prove zealous of the good thing, literally, in the singular, for what is good. In verse 14, we title this, Undeserved Suffering Equals Blessing. But even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed. Yet the strong adversity, Paul Hall, denoting a stark contrast to verse 13, A-L-L-A, Paul with the ascending use of the conjunction chi, even. But even so, if you should suffer, here we have a fourth class condition. Introduced by the particle I. Fourth class condition indicates a possible condition in the future. Usually it's a remote possibility. You would say if perhaps, though highly unlikely. This is rare in the New Testament, the fourth class condition, extremely rare. It suggests that the leadership has not yet suffered for righteousness. And the possibility of such happening soon is remote in contrast to verse 13, taken as face value. The idea being there is that if matters should actually come to the point of suffering as otherwise implied. It suggests that his readers have been largely insulated from suffering thus far. This is the Wallace to the Greek grammar beyond the basics as he seeks to explain the fourth class condition in this particular verse. But we'll look at it and see what the Bible has to say. In regards to the context. So, but in, even if, in the remote future, if you will, you should suffer. you should suffer then the particle, conditional particles followed by the present active optitude move in regards to the verb pasco, to suffer. P-A-S-C-H-O. If you should suffer, again, looks at the optitude, looks at the future. This move itself is only 76 times in the New Testament. It complements the rhetorical question of verse 13 indirectly. You should suffer. Who does there harm you? But if you should suffer, the rhetorical question, no one. But then on the other hand, if you should suffer. So that in itself tells you that suffering is not out of the picture. That's not the point. For the sake of righteousness, because of, for the sake of, is the use of the preposition dia or dia, followed with our noun for righteousness, details sune. E-I-K-A-I-O-S-U-N-E. The phrase you are blessed is simply the adjective nominating as the plural for blessed, makarios. Used 50 times. M-A-K-A-R-I-O-S. You know, in a beatitude here, or anachronism, as it might be called. And he continues, and do not fear their intimidation, and do not be troubled with respect to potential suffering, as is so related. You have the conjunction death, yes, would be a better translation problem for you. Do not fear. Here you have the imperative, aorist passive of our term for fear, phobeo, P-H-O-B-E-O. Do not be afraid of. Their intimidation. We have a relative pronoun, autos, in the plural, third person plural, A-U-T-O-S. Be fear, definite article with the noun for fear, phobos. H-O-D-O-S. Here, fear, intimidation. Literally, in the Greek, do not fear their fear. And do not be troubled. You have the negative, compound negative conjunction, medes, M-E-D-E. And do not be troubled. You have the second imperative here, aorist passive. This term translates trouble. Tarasso, P-A-R-A-S-S-O. It means shaken or stirred up. Like my martini, Tarasso, shaken. It means be troubled, agitated, or upset. It's used 17 times. Okay, we're reading the two verses. And who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed. And do not fear their intimidation, and do not be troubled. Alright, now this is verses 13 and 14. 1. Peter now takes the preceding Old Testament reference of verses 10 through 12 and brings them to bear on the specific situation at hand for these believers for all intent and purpose. Again, dealing with the issue of peace, that's the underlying thought in regard to Peter's context here, that is weaved throughout this session. He appeals to the Old Testament text from Psalm 34 in verses 10 through 12 in regards to one who desires to love life and see good days, to hold back his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking guile. Let him turn away from evil and do good. Let him seek peace and pursue it. In verse 12, the contrast is given between the individual who does that versus those who are, if you will, negative. For the eyes of the Lord upon the righteous, and his ears attend to their prayer, but the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. So he takes now those Old Testament passages, and he brings them to bear on the primary issue of addressing these particular believers for all intents and purposes. And two, he does so by inserting his own question at the end of it all, replacing the one omitted in Psalm 34 that began it. And who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? whereas Psalm 34, David in the song, who is there that desires good life? Obviously appealing to people. Whereas Peter uses an application in regards to believers sustaining peace. And here he inserts his own question. Who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? 3, the question itself is rhetorical and expects a negative answer, no one. So 4, as noted in the analysis of verses 10 through 12, Peter applies a psalm reference to emphasize what the positive believer is willing to do to experience the good life. He's willing to overrule the FCA in speech and actions and pursue, obviously, peace according to the dictates of God. To seek it. And therefore, God's for them. And will provide peace in their lives. So 5, the seeking and pursuit of peace capitalizes on what God has to offer in His plan of salvation and to apply to life. When you truly seek peace as stipulated by God and pursue it, you capitalize on God's plan of salvation in the form of blessing in your life. 6 is a psalm further made clear in contrast to positive volition pursuing peace, whom God is for. There are others that remain negative, whom God is against. That was the final statement. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil, in contrast to those who are the righteous. So 7, those that seek peace and pursue it under divine constraints, verses 10 through 11, earlier, are those that are righteous. They parallel one another. They are the righteous whom the Lord fastidiously watches out for and attends to their prayers. So again, those that seek peace and pursue it under divine constraints are those that are righteous. 8, this in contrast to a world of negative volition, often hostile otherwise. So 9, this brings out the main body of the epistle and primary purpose for writing, that is, to encourage these early believers experiencing suffering at the hands of negative antagonists. Again, in the angelic conflict, do not mislead believers to hook in with sound doctrine that somehow now their life is going to be rose petals and be looking through primrose glasses and all things. No, you've entered into a conflict. And you become aware of it for the first time in your life. It's called the angelic conflict. Conflict between positive and negative volition. Those who line up with the truth of Bible doctrine versus those who take issue with it and are hostile to it. And hence, obviously, he does not want his readers to be misinformed, number one. They are experiencing these things. And to be able to defend themselves doctrinally in this respect. And hence, that's one of the primary issues in regards to why he writes this epistle. So, 10, Peter takes the psalm reference to now bring to center stage the issue of undeserved suffering these Asian churches face. 11, he begins to interweave a series and strain of the thoughts to further encourage these believers in the face of this reality. From 13, essentially down through 16, 17, he will build upon this premise and give them food for thought, doctrinally speaking, in regards to facing this conflict, facing antagonism, and having the doctrinal wherewithal to have the confidence to be able to be successful in meeting these tests and not become discouraged and otherwise capitulate over it. So he begins to interweave here a series of strands of thoughts to further encourage these believers in the face of this reality. At 12, he begins with an absolute, which is verse 13. That is designed to build further confidence, verse 14. And then he will appeal to the basis for confidence found in Christ's victory and privilege of sharing in his glory and the remainder of the chapter, verses 15 through 22. So, he begins with an absolute truth to establish his basis of argument and polemic in regards to encouraging and arming these believers spiritually, mentally, and otherwise in facing their conflicts in life with negative volition. So 13, the thrust of his opening question, verse 13 is this. If God is on the side of the positive and the just, and against those that practice evil, what harm can possibly come to those who do good? That's the thrust of this opening rhetorical question. Who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? And that obviously draws upon his previous statement taken from the Psalms that God is against evil, that he's for the righteous. So the thrust again of the question, of his rhetorical question, if God is on the side of the positive and the just, and against those who practice evil, what harm can possibly come to those who do good? So 14, the force of the rhetorical here is presented with concrete and impervious logic. Can't tear it down. Not in regards to any type of biblical response in this regard. 15, the opening conjunction, and, which is kai in the Greek, is here best translated then, or now, or besides. For the eyes of the Lord are upon the righteous, verse 12, for his ears attend to their prayer, but the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. Besides, or then, who is there to harm you? See. That's the force of the conjunction here. 16, it has the gist of transition between the Psalm quotation of verses 10 through 12, with verse 13 implying, in light of what has just been said, or, quote, under the circumstances of what's just been said. 17, it integrates the idea that the question Peter here proposes is designed to be considered on the basis of the teaching brought out in verses 10 through 12. 18, the main idea and intent of the teaching was captured in verse 12, denoting God is for the righteous and against evil. The righteous further delineated previously in regards to what they do to maintain God's orientation of God's will in their lives, of seeking peace and pursuing it, and keeping their conduct and actions, the SCA, overruled adequately in this respect. So the main idea and intent of the teaching was captured in verse 12, denoting God is for the righteous and against the evil. After all the verses were said and done, that was the main idea that came out of it. 19, that reality that God's for the righteous against the evil is a biblical absolute that provides the rhetorical basis Peter's question now is built upon. An absolute, something that is irrevocable. It will not be changed. Immutable, as God is immutable. Here, Proverbs 3:33. God is always for the righteous, but he's always postured against evil. His disposition has never changed. From eternity past, when you first had the fall of the angels, till the end of history. This is his attitude, this way it always will be. And therefore, it is an absolute. Proverbs 3:33. Regards to God, the curse of the Lord is on the house of the wicked, but he blesses the dwelling of the righteous. 11:21. Surely the evil man will not go unpunished, but the sinners of the righteous will be delivered. 14:19. The evil will bow down before the good, and the wicked at the gates of the righteous. ultimate vindication. For Ecclesiastes 12:14. For God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. All these things will be divided and exposed for what they are, and He will react according to righteousness. And that's how we know this whole thing is absolute, because it's based on God's righteousness. Is it absolute? Yes, it is. So His argument is based on an absolute. And then John 5:29, in regards to Christ's right to judge, it goes beyond anything temporal into all eternity, denoting again the absolute condition that is presented in John 5:29. And shall those who shall come forth, those who did the good work, to a resurrection of life, that's eternal life. Those who committed the evil, to a resurrection of judgment. Again, denoting the absolute posture of God based on one's orientation in regards to the justice of God. And hence, He here presents, reveals to us, if you will, verse 12, that denotes an absolute biblical premise, an absolute truism. 20, the rhetorical idea is thus, in regards to the question. If the preceding is an absolute, and it is, that God's for the righteous and against the evil, then absolutely, nothing can overturn or prevent its concluding results. It is an absolute. If it's righteousness, it's absolute, and this is based on righteousness. It's God's righteousness. Obviously, nothing can break that righteousness if it's absolute. Otherwise, it ceases to be absolute. And then this is based on God's character, if you will, which is tied to this absolute condition. So the rhetorical idea is that the preceding is an absolute in his argument, in his polemic here. And it is. And stick with me, because going through these verses, I guarantee you, when we go through these verses for the rest of Peter, if you miss any facts, you better get a tape, because you'll be lost. He really comes in with some really deep theology. You wouldn't think that you're reading the writings of a fisherman who doesn't have a formal education. You know, a higher education in regards to theology that and how he deals with it in this area. But anyway, that's my warning to you. The rhetorical idea is that the proceeding is an absolute, and it is, and absolutely nothing can overturn or prevent its concluding results. So 21, that conclusion is to be understood in Peter's question. The rhetorical nature of it, who can harm you? No one, if you prove zealous for what is good. Because it's based on an absolute. And therefore, it will not be overturned. It will not change this condition. So 22, now the future participle, who is there to harm, ho kakos, draws off this cognate noun evil, kakos, in verse 12c. That the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. So the one doing harm plays off that term of those who do evil, in verse 12c. So 23, this noun is designed to point to negative volition that practices evil of whom the Lord is against. 24, specifically in context, it points to negative volition that is inclined to inflict suffering upon the positive believer. Peter's emphasis and exhortation on suffering goes beyond just normal suffering. He's dealing with the antagonism that believers face in other people. That's his primary concern. So 25, this verb, this verb is used of the Jewish believers suffering at the hands of the Egyptians. It's used of King Herod opposing the church in Jerusalem. And unbelieving Jewish leaders inciting antagonism amongst the Gentiles against Paul and Barnabas. It's used there of the Jews suffering at the hand of the Egyptians, Acts 7, 6 and 19. So to get a feel of this word, and where intent of use here. Acts 7:16. And from there they were moved to Shechem and laid in a tomb which Abraham had purchased for
us.
7:6, excuse me. That God spoke to his effects that his offspring would be aliens in a foreign land, and that they would be enslaved and mistreated for 400 years, or term mistreated. Verse 19. It was he who took shrewd advantage of our race and mistreated our fathers, the Pharaoh, who knew not Joseph. That's verse 18. Until there arose another king over Egypt who knew nothing about Joseph. Joseph, during that time, there was good rapport between the Jews and the Egyptians because of Joseph's position and his support of the Jews, etc. But the time went on and things changed. So that's your context. And that Pharaoh who knew not Joseph, was he who took shrewd advantage of our race and mistreated our fathers so that they would expose their infants and they would not survive. Bring about genocide, things of this nature, oppression, etc. It is used in Acts 12, 1 and 2 of King Herod, opposing the church in Jerusalem. Now, about that time, Herod the king laid hands on some who belonged to the church in order to mistreat them, harm them. And he had James, the brother of John, put to death with a sword. And then it's used in Acts 14 to the Gentiles trying to stir up the Jewish leaders trying to stir up the Gentiles to do harm to Paul and Barnabas. Acts 14:2, the Jews of disbelief stirred up the minds of the Gentiles and bittered them against the brothers. So 26, that volition, now in regards to analyzing the question, that volition is another ingredient central to Peter's argument here. It's made clear in the conditional portion of the verse, if you prove zealous for what is good. So 27, the third class condition, maybe yes or maybe no, maybe no, indicates that the hypothesis, that's the result or the end of the hypothesis, the end was, if so-and-so, then that's your hypothesis. The end part is the hypothesis. So the third class condition indicates that the hypothesis is dependent upon one's choice for good, the result. The absolute argument in regards to one harming you, if you prove zealous for what is good, is dependent upon volition, positive volition. If you want the result, which is actually stated at the beginning of the verse, who is there to harm you? Here in the verse, you have the apostles present first, the apostles then Paul's. So that's 28. The apostles is presented in the opening of the verse, then who is there to harm you? So again, the apostles, if you prove zealous for what is good, their last condition may be yes or no, then the result, the ending result, then who is there to harm you? It's a sense. So 29. The third class condition points out that to be guaranteed of the absolute promise within it is dependent upon whether one is positive or not. In other words, the rhetorical expected answer of no one is only applicable and beneficial for those who are positive. The Bible doesn't leave anything unturned. So a third class condition here points out that to be guaranteed an absolute promise presented is dependent upon whether one is positive or not. 30, the phrase, prove zealous for what is good, rehashes the positive imperatives in verse 11, back in verse 11, to do good and seek peace and pursue it. That harks back to that aspect of the Psalms. In regards to turning away from evil, the contrasting aspect of turning away from evil is doing good, is seeking peace and pursuing it. So he's emphasizing the positive aspects, and it harks back to that. So it rehashes those imperatives to do good and seek peace and pursue it. 31, the neuter singular of the adjective good, agathos, if you presuppose for what is good in our verse, it's literally a good thing, is the same gender in person, the same adjective used in verse 11. Do good. It's agathos, same thing, same form, same person, same gender, do the good thing. So those two things match up dramatically. So 32, now the nominative noun zealous, they slow taste, literally, which is a zealot or one who is zealous, clearly describe the one that seeks peace with intensive pursuit in verse 11. One who seeks peace and pursues it, that is a zealot. One who is zealous in regards to God's plan of peace. So, the adjective here summarily describes the one who seeks peace with intensive pursuit. And we denote the intensive action in regards to those verbs of seeking and pursuing when we get those verses. So 33, to become the zealot of, quote, the good thing, end quote, is to actively and continuously pursue God's righteousness. God's righteousness is his directed will. It describes what the good thing is. Become a zealot of the good thing is to actively and continuously pursue God's righteousness, in contrast to the evil that personifies negative volition. For the eyes of the Lord are upon the righteous. Righteous are those that describe those who do good and seek peace and pursue it. So all of those principles fall in together. They're all part of the same package. And to do the good thing is to actively pursue this righteousness. What is God's righteousness? It's his directed will. Being in fellowship and applying Bible doctrine. That's the good thing. See. So 34, as verse 11 made clear, his demand that the believer practice or apply this righteousness and intensely at all times seek to maintain peace before God and man. Turn away from evil, do good, let him seek peace and pursue it. 35. This paints a comprehensive picture of positive volition that is willing to overrule the SCA and apply Bible doctrine even in the face of antagonism. The hostile attacks do not change one's course and God's will for their life in regards to not doing evil, but doing good, and seeking peace and pursuing it. And so all this paints what you would expect from positive volition, and their willingness to overrule the sin nature and apply doctrine in the face even of negative volition and their antagonism. So 36, now the aorist subjunctive verb here, prove, which is genomai, literally become, indicates potential and further points to the self-discipline positive volition exercises in applying Bible doctrine. To be positive is not some dormant, neutral state of being. James made this very clear. Being positive is action, willful action upon the believer, from the believer, in regards to pursuing God's plan and applying Bible doctrine in their life. A person can't sit on their duff and not do anything. I don't care what lip service they give otherwise in regards to Christianity, in regards to lining up with God's plan and claim to be positive. They're not. Positive volition is an expression but acting will, acting faith, both inhale and exhale faith in this respect. And the subjunctive mood to prove one or to give evidence, to prove zealous, to give evidence of being a zealot, a zealot in this regard, demands that one is actively applying Bible doctrine. So 37, application of righteousness is the evidence or proof of quality volition. Principle clearly delineated in James 2:23. Well, time's up. Let's go ahead and take a break here, and we'll take the second session.